This podcast is hosted by Chris Finkston and Spencer Oliver. They are both experienced paramedics. They've done everything from 911 ground ambulance to volunteer fire department work and are both currently flight paramedics. This podcast reviews scenarios based on real calls run by real out-of-hospital clinicians. Details are changed to protect the privacy of those involved and to present educational opportunities to the listener. This podcast is EMS 2020.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of EMS 2020. Yep. This is our little show where people send us calls and we review them and see if we can learn from them, be it good lessons or things to avoid. So, yeah, we're going to do that today. My name is Chris and that is Spencer. Spencer, how are you?
Hey, I was doing really well until about, I don't know. I don't know how long it's been now. It's been many days.
Yeah.
Not only do people send us calls, they send us better titles to the names.
Oh, yeah. No. I know the one that you're talking about. So our last, I'll let you say the title since you brought it to my attention. But so our last episode was about a patient who fell down into a ditch. You should go listen to the episode because why they were in the ditch is actually really an interesting reveal. But they were low down in a ditch and they were also hypothermic. We named the episode Falling into Hypoglycemia. But yeah, someone else got it way better.
Yeah.
I'm upset.
I have name envy all of a sudden because it was perfect because I went on like this whole little spiel about, you know, the CBG being low and Jacob on Instagram wrote in and said the title could have been Low and Be Cold. And
oh my God, it's amazing.
It broke me in that moment.
It's the best title. I mean, go Jacob. I mean, just cranking it out of the park. And I think we even had like a Dragons theme, a House of the Dragon theme or Game of Thrones, whichever one you're
watching. Game of Thrones and Double Dragon. There was a dragon theme throughout it.
So like Low and Be Cold, like it just makes so much sense. I think you even made a joke about how low, what it meant in olden times, which is this is the best part. I mean, it was just such a thematic... Jacob, you're hired. You're hired.
Chris, you're fired.
I'm gonna deactivate Spencer. So yeah, with that, if you guys would also like to suggest better titles than the BS we come up with, you can hit us up on social media. We are EMS20/20 on Facebook and EMS2020 show on Instagram. And if you want your call to appear on this show, email it to us. It's EMS2020podcast@gmail.com. And let's transition to talking about something I'm very fond of, the Rapid Sequence Information YouTube channel. That's right. We have a YouTube channel now. It's Rapid Sequence Information. There's a whopping three videos if you count our little intro, but there's a whopping two videos up there, but there are more episodes to come. So the first episode that's up there is we talk about the Rhode Island unrecognized esophageal intubation case that came out a number of years ago. And a lot of people really want to blame EMT cardiacs for it, and we make a case for why the article does not provide enough evidence to actually do that. But we have part two coming up because part one got a lot of attention from, people in Rhode Island. So we're delaying part two a little bit because we got kind of some inside track and some inside opinions on how things are rolling down there. So,
it's interesting.
Yeah. We're not going to change the outcome of part two that much. I mean, our message is still going to be the same, but man, there's some other points that we have to make. Like there's potential biases that probably should have been highlighted in the article that absolutely, or not biases, but potential, biases, conflict of interest that should have been, that's what I'm looking for. This should have been highlighted in the article that were not of various parties involved. So yeah, it's going to be great. We also have another one coming up where we talk about a bag valve mask that does not deliver the amount of oxygen that it should. And it's actually still out there and still being manufactured. So we're going to release that. In fact, it provides significantly less oxygen under certain circumstances than it should. So thankfully, it's not like a brand I've heard of a whole lot, but it is for sale in the US. Some people do have it and it's worth watching. So that's what's coming up on the Rapid Sequence Information YouTube channel. Please go get subscribed and drop a like. It really helps us out and we'd appreciate it. And finally, if you're looking for EMS 2020 merch, which a lot of you are. We actually stopped talking about merch for a while. I don't know why, because it does great every time we bring it up. Go That's check true. Out our EMS 2020 merch page on our TeePublic page. You can find links on our social media in the descriptions. And yeah, it's great because you can get t-shirts, you can get mugs. We have a peanut butter spider sandwich t-shirt, which doesn't actually have our name on it like anywhere. It's just a peanut butter spider sandwich. Oddly sells very well. And people are going to ask you like, what the fuck, man? It's a great little shindig. You should go check out our merch page. And again, merch, that's mine. It goes directly to us because of the merch you guys bought. We were actually able to buy and essentially convert one of the rooms in my house into an actual acoustically treated expensive equipment studio. So which is why I always sound better than Spencer, who records in a closet.
I'm in a garage with like crates and blankets.
Never mind. You've upgraded. Last episode, he was legit in a closet. But let's get on to what we do best, and that is look at how other people actually work and then take pop shots from a distance.
There we go. All right. Well, hey, guys, here's some themes, learning points that are probably going to come up in this episode. We're going to discuss one of my favorite topics, how to cast a wide net. We're also going to talk about syncope. And some of those differentials that should probably be considered along with that. And, of course, the surprise lesson.
Ooh, like a surprise lesson.
We're going to start this week's call talking about who gave us this call. So, I recently listened to an episode where I was like, oh, wow, I decided to do it with my left hand. Like, we went right to the system first. Right. It was weird.
Shaboom, which that's where I like to go, but anyway.
So this story comes to us from a paramedic by the name of Snake Eyes. Snake Eyes has 2 years of experience as a paramedic.
All right, 2 away from Ultimate Doom, so that's good.
They are working with an EMT Advanced known as Duke C. Tatum.
Yeah, so an EMT Advanced, I mean, honestly, like, there's the inner EMT scope, but the intermediary levels actually vary the most from state to state. When you talk about, like, EMT versus paramedic, and then you have these intermediary levels. EMT Advanced is an intermediary level. Usually means that it's an EMT that can also start an IV and give additional medications, but depending on what state you're in, the intermediary levels can change drastically. Case in point. Rhode Island. Go check out RSI to find out exactly why it's different.
Perfect.
Anyway.
All right. So Snake Eyes and the Duke work for a private ambulance company. They work 12-hour shifts in a dynamic deployment model. Notice I didn't do system status this time. You would be so proud. You should be so proud.
Yes. Yeah, I would. Very few things. Very few people do true system status. Very, very few. I won't get into why that is. If you want to know, email me or hit it up on social media, and I will regale you.
It's good. This is a large and busy agency, and they work alongside multiple different fire agencies. Yeah.
Oh, but really quick, dynamic deployment model in a nutshell, if you don't know what that is, that's essentially you don't have stations. Usually what that means is you have posts around a county or a municipality, and basically those posts are, depending on what level you have, in other words, how many available ambulances you have, that will change on what post you keep staffed. Or you might have a post that's midway between two posts if you only have one ambulance, that kind of stuff. So it's dynamic. You don't always have these places staffed. Versus a static deployment would be like a fire station, which is, you can't really move a fire station. It's there.
But, all right, anyway. Challenge accepted.
So yeah. Challenge accepted. I mean, but, well, okay. There are kind of some dynamicness even to fire stations, but I'm not going to get into that, so we'll move on.
Fair enough. So here's the thing, Chris. This is really the interesting piece to me. Because you and I have worked for a private ground company where, you know, like, we worked with different fire agencies. But at this place, a lot of the surrounding agencies are BLS. Like, they transport, they're BLS transport. Not all of them, but many of them. Mm-hmm. So that is really, to me, again, the most interesting part here. They'll have, you know, like, they have their ALS guys kind of in this center core, and then they'll do mutual aid with these BLS ambulances if they need ALS support. Anyway, because of this, the ambulance service has actually a pretty large response area, and they run that mix of like urban and rural, though, you know, again, in their area, it's mostly urban. Hospital choice doesn't really factor in, so I'm not going to include all the details, but the hospital that is involved with this call is a large service hospital that can handle the things, as I say.
Okay, perfect.
Typical staffing is an EMT medic. Snake Eyes works an overnight 12, and interestingly enough, Snake Eyes has enough seniority at their service to move into a day shift should they choose, but they prefer nights because their words are, the calls are better. Which it turns out to mean, like, they feel like they're more serious calls, and they also run less interfacility transfers, which their service also provides to the area.
I would also like to point out that this is a good indication of the state of staffing in EMS when Snake Eyes, who has 2 years, has enough seniority to pick daytime or nighttime.
Yeah.
I'm just going to point that out.
It's so good.
Yeah.
All right.
That's two whole years.
Well, it's 11:41:03. Snake Eyes and Duke C. Tatum are resting, air quotes there, resting, at one of their posts, which is a gas station parking lot, in a covert spot where the levels of light are low enough to permit this resting. And I think it's worth pointing out that Duke is taking educational courses and attending those classes during the day before coming to work. Snake Eyes, however, is reportedly rested, but, you know, like, who's going to refuse a nap when the opportunity arrives? So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't.
You know, it's sort of like me in an EMS room with good food. Like, I could have just eaten, but, like, if there's a walnut wrap or, you know, some other really delicious item, like, I will take that. I'm like, well.
Yeah. That's the hard part about the job you and I have, is that we have bases that are well-stocked with snacks, so it's like living in an EMS room.
That's true, yeah.
Kind of terrible.
All right. Well, Chris, suddenly, General Flag, their dispatcher, sends an alert page to their unit announcing that they are to respond to intercept with a BLS ambulance unit for an adult male chief complaint of syncope. Further notes indicate that the patient's family called and the patient is intoxicated. They depart code 3 and to intercept with that BLS unit at a predetermined rendezvous spot, which happens to be the BLS ambulance services fire department's parking lot.
Okay. So the fire department is BLS. Yes,
the fire department is BLS, and they have a BLS ambulance service that also works out at that area that does. Yeah.
Okay. So, I understand. And they are stationed at that.
They are rendezvousing at that fire department.
Gotcha. So our ALS ambulance with Snake Eyes is going to go rendezvous with a BLS unit at the fire department parking lot.
All right.
Got it.
It's about a 20-minute drive from their location. Snake Eyes has their eyes on the road because they're driving, so good on them. And Duke goes back to sleep because it's 20 minutes away and he's been in school all day. So
is this the lights and sirens run?
Yeah, this is lights and sirens at 11:41:04 now. I don't.
So no lights or sirens coming
out. So Snake Eyes reports the following. Sometimes these are nothing and sometimes they're serious. So they have sort of a wait and see approach for the call. And that's kind of their pre-gaming. They're like, well, we'll find out when we get there. But they, you know, they know that at least there are two EMTs who are currently doing patient care. So there's that.
That's good.
So anyway, they arrive the next day, Chris, to the BLS fire department and find.
Oh, because it's 11:41 when they got the call, right? Sorry, I believe you said, according to my whiteboard, 11:41 and it's either 03 or 05 because I write like shit.
It's one of those, sure. Right. Yeah, so they arrive the next day to the BLS fire department and find that BLS ambulance parked in a side parking lot and they pull up alongside it. There is one firefighter EMT from the fire department on scene, and there are two EMTs in the ambulance. And real quick, the ambulance is staffed with compensated EMTs, and so these guys are reportedly paid on a per diem basis. And if they don't have staffing, then there is no BLS ambulance response, and their area relies on, like, mutual aid from this main service or others. So anyway, Snake Eyes goes to make contact with the BLS unit while Duke fetches their cot. All right, so Snake Eyes recognizes the firefighter as C.C. Gordon L. But as that's a mouthful, Chris, we'll just call them C.C. Mm-hmm. So okay. Snake Eyes sees C.C. and C.C. acknowledges them by indicating in tone and body language that this is a bullshit call.
Gotcha. Okay. And I know that body
language. Don't we though? All right. So yeah. Snake Eyes kind of goes like, all right. They enter the side door of the ambulance and see Scarlet EMT and Ripcord EMT. And of course, the patient, who's noted to be kind of laying upright on the cot with an empty emesis bag in their hand. And we'll get more on them in a moment.
So I think this is the theme that I thought you were going with ever since you said Snake Eyes. I won't reveal the theme. Oh.
Is this sort of like, ahead. Well, I know the theme, but I don't want to give it away. So like you tell me.
I know the theme and no. I know the theme.
Okay.
And given what you just said, I think the theme may give things away. But also, I may name the episode after this. I don't know. But anyway, yeah. It's G.I. Joe's.
That's what it is. All right, yes.
The theme is G.I. Joe's. All right,
perfect.
Yep.
All right.
Yep. Anyway, go ahead. Snake Eyes was the bad guy in G.I. Joe's as well. So I'm sorry, Snake Eyes, whoever you are that submitted this call, that we're making you a villain.
Wait, what? I Wikipedia'd this, and I thought Snake Eyes was a good guy in the movie.
Is he in the movie? Oh, you're right. You're right. No. Cobra Commander is the bad guy. Okay. Snake Eyes is a good guy. Yeah. Snake Eyes is a good guy. Like, never mind. Sorry, Snake Eyes.
Wikipedia might have lied to me.
Yeah. I mean, rare, but could have been.
Right. Where was I? All right. So
we have Scarlet and Ripcord. I just wrote down. So you have those two.
Well, Scarlet,
you've introduced them.
Was PIC. And so they give report to Snake Eyes. All right. So,
and we're in the back of their ambulance.
All right. So
okay, gotcha.
This is Joe, which is obviously not their real name. He's 54. Right. And tonight the son called into the fire station saying that Joe had passed out, getting up from the couch and possibly had a seizure. When we got there, Joe was alert and oriented. They denied any pain. They just said they felt like they were having some heart palpitations and they report feeling very nauseated.
Oh, that's not all fun.
Right. So Snake Eyes follows up on the syncope, like, okay, hold on. So, like, was this witnessed? How long were they unconscious for? What did they fall on? And they learn the following. The patient apparently, stood up from their couch. Their eyes kind of rolled back, and they fell backwards onto the couch and then shook. The adult son, the patient's adult son, who was in the room with him, immediately went over to check on him and then moved him so that he was kind of lying supine on the couch. So face up on the couch. After moving the patient into that position, the patient woke up. So they were probably unconscious for about a minute.
All right.
More history of present illness is attained. Some of it via the tap on the worksheet and notice the encircled writing method. So Joe's son had apparently told the BLS crew in confidence that their father is an alcoholic and a binge drinker, and he has been drinking heavily over this weekend. And just this evening, Joe has had 4 24-ounce malt liquors.
I think I just now understand what you meant by the circled writing. So
go ahead.
Someone wrote a message on a piece of paper and then circled it and then silently showed it to the oncoming crew.
Perfect. Yep. That's exactly it. Yep.
Gotcha. All right. So the HPI, that is someone from the BLS ambulance wrote a message on a piece of paper, circled it, and then held it up like a banner behind the patient's head for us to get the real message. Yep. Okay.
Gotcha. Exactly. All right. We'll move on to the past medical history. The patient's a type 2 diabetic. They have a history of atrial fibrillation, hypertension. They have a history of GERD. They are obese and they have diabetic neuropathy. For medications, Snake Eyes wrote "see plastic bag" because there was a plastic bag that was handed with medications.
Oh God! And,
yeah, well,
I have a gross story. Finish what you're saying. I have a gross story I have to tell, and I'm gonna tell it now too. Right. And I'm sorry for anyone who doesn't like our stories. But.
And Scarlet says that the patient's been compliant with their medication. So allergies. Allergic to aspirin, but now tell me your story because I don't care anymore about this and I want to hear the gross story.
This is it just reminded me of I had an immediate kind of reaction when he said plastic bag, because it just forever I will remember this call. It was kind of a similar situation, and it was a guy who he had a plastic bag full of all sorts of prescription bottles at his feet, sitting in a recliner, and he never really got up out of his recliner. He just sat in his recliner and like peed and did whatever he had to do. There was so much pet hair that the carpet, you weren't sure. I'm like, is this how the carpet's supposed to be? Or is this just
like,
pets?
Wow, has this been here since the 70s? Like shag carpet. Nice.
So his pants are soaked in urine and everything's soaked in urine. And this plastic bag that's at his feet, I opened it up to see what was in there. And like everything inside was wet. And I realized it's probably because it's full of urine as well. And all the medications, the labels, the water from him pissing all over them, had just basically made the labels all blank. And so we had no idea like what anything was saying, God. But it was just this gross. But that's the grossest part about that is like he had had like he had like a bag of like a little like the little bag of like Ruffles potato chips, and it was just this disgusting bag of peed on for days, what I'm assuming was at one point potato chips inside this thing. And so we're kind of like pulling out medication bottles, and of course it's like it's not contained, you know, so it's all over, so you're like pulling out medication bottles that smell deeply of urine that are caked in pee and Ruffles potato chips. Anyway, soggy potato chip bits.
Yeah.
Like a malto meal.
I wonder how many people are listening to this while like eating.
Specifically Ruffles ruffle potato chips. Anyway. So there we go. That I had to tell that. I'm sorry. Let's keep
this episode brought to you by Ruffles. If that story doesn't ruffle your feathers, I don't know what will. All right.
Get a bag of Ruffles today. Mixed with pee for easy digestion.
All right. So vitals, by the way, when Scarlett and Ripcord got there, the heart rate was documented at 130 beats per minute and irregular. Again, the patient does have that history of atrial fibrillation. Scarlett said their SpO2 reading gave a heart rate that fluctuated between like 100 and 130. So,
okay, yep. Gotcha. That was actually a question.
SpO2 was 93% via their portable finger probe, and a blood pressure they have is 108 over 90, and the breathing rate was documented as 12. Scarlett says with the syncope, nausea, and the high heart rate, it felt like ALS was warranted. So, Chris, here's the thing. We haven't seen anything but the back of the patient's head and like a hand holding an emesis bag. But based on the information so far, what are your thoughts? Like, what would be your top concerns with this patient?
So right off the bat, I mean, so the patient is tachycardic, and there's a lot of like different reasons that could be, especially if someone's been binge drinking and they've been vomiting. So the tachycardia that could be due to dehydration. It would also explain like why the patient stands up and then falls over, that kind of stuff going on. 93%, is the patient on oxygen?
They are not on oxygen.
Okay, so 93%. I mean, that's not like crushingly low, but alcohol is a respiratory depressant. If it is present today, I mean, there's no reason to not put oxygen on this guy. The blood pressure is my biggest concern right now. And here's why. The blood pressure stands out to me because, I mean, the systolic is 108, which isn't, but the problem is the diastolic is 90.
Yeah.
That's the problem that bothers me. And so that usually means you have a pretty decent level of vasoconstriction going on. That's what a high diastolic number means. And so since we have a low systolic with a high diastolic, that is usually indicative of some kind of hypovolemia, because you don't have enough volume to push a high systolic, but your body, because you don't have that volume, has clamped down on your vasculature so hard that your diastolic is right behind your systolic. And that's not a good sign. So, my top concern in this patient is some kind of hypovolemia that could be going on, because he's kind of painting that picture. And that would explain all the guy's symptoms, from the syncope, the tachycardia, those kind of things.
Okay.
So I think we need to prioritize vascular access on this guy.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. So Here we go. Let's shift our attention over to the patient. Joe is a 54-year-old man.
Oh, really quick. One other thing I will add is what I would then do is focus my next questioning and assessments on figuring out what kind of hypovolemia this could be. Are we hypovolemic because we're potentially septic and sick? Is there some kind of a cold bleeding we don't know about? Start asking questions about, good questions. Like, here, start asking, like, GI bleed questions, bowel movements, that kind of stuff, as of late. You know, when they vomited, what exactly did they vomit up? Those kind of things. Move into, I'd also start asking about, like, okay, like, I know they've been drinking. Have they had a fever at all, you know, recently? And just kind of based off my past experience with that I just told you guys about the soggy bag and a guy sitting in a chair urinating all over himself, frequency of urination for possible UTI is also something to consider. So, yeah, start really looking down for like what are those things that can cause people to be hypovolemic in a hurry? And that those are the two routes I'd really start going down at this point. I think at some point a 12 lead may be warranted as well. But anyway,
Okay. Oh, you know what? I was going to say, like, no, Chris, pencils down. You can't slide in your answer. But it was actually... It was a really good answer, so I'll accept it. All right.
Okay.
Okay, so here we are, shifting our attention over to the patient. Pencils down. Joe is a 54-year-old male, estimated to be about 6 feet tall, or 1.8 meters, and the patient's about 290 pounds, or roughly 130 kilograms. It doesn't exactly add up. There's someone who's going to be like, that is not exact, and I know that. And I don't care. Fight me.
Seems because it did sound like you were making it up right then and there because you did kind of lag. And I was about to make fun of you because I'm like, dude, you're not making it up. You wrote it down. You're just trying to sound smart right now. But now I'm actually pretty convinced. I'm actually going to do the math.
I already heard the people going like, hey, man, you fucked up the math.
Oh. No. Yeah, you were actually way off. 130 kilograms comes up to 286 pounds, not 290 pounds.
Yeah, but. I wanted the 130. I like 130. Anyway.
Yeah. So sorry, you're 4 pounds off.
This
there,
is
buddy.
EMS. Round numbers are okay. Yeah. All right. So Snake says that the patient's overall appearance is that of a person who really doesn't take great care of themselves at baseline. Introductions are made, and here is the overall assessment. So level of consciousness, the patient is a GCS 14. That's 3 for eyes, 5 for verbal, and 6 for motor.
Okay. So the patient has their eyes closed but opens with verbal. Okay. Other than that, everything else normal.
They're oriented, but Snake notes that the patient does appear to be intoxicated to some degree based on the responses. The patient does slur a word or two. And the other thing that they do is they're very kind of emotional in their response. It's like, I'm so sorry, you guys are great, etc., that kind of stuff. Yeah. Anyway.
Sounds like drunk guy things to say. Yeah. But
right?
Anyway.
Yeah. The airway is patent. Breathing. Snake notices that the patient is breathing a bit faster than 12 a minute. They find them breathing at a rate more like 22 a minute.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Yeah.
They do not palpate a pulse here. The patient was alert and talking to them, so the circulation was sort of presumed. Anyway, Snake asks the patient, what happened? And the patient says, I'm a drunk. Snake responds.
All right.
Snake responds with it sounds like you passed out onto the couch after standing up. And the patient says, I guess so. Snake and the patient do have a brief back and forth where they ask the patient if they're having any pain, if they feel lightheaded, if they feel nauseated. And the patient basically relays that. No, they're not having any pain, but they can feel their heart beating a little bit and they feel nauseous and they repeat the remorseful but I'm just a drunk, you know. Duke Tatum, who entered the ambulance through the rear doors at some point during this exchange, asked the patient well, do you want to go to the hospital? Because CC, the Cobra Commander, the firefighter outside, had allegedly made a comment to Duke when both of them were outside, which I'll just kind of encapsulate here, which was yeah, no shit, he passed out. He drank 4 24-ounce malt liquors.
Woo, get it done.
In the evening, yeah. So, dying. Yeah. And the patient says, my son says he wants me to go, and reiterates the remorse about drinking again. That's going to be a constant theme, guys.
Yeah.
All right. So the patient is taking out, Excuse me. The patient is taken out of the BLS ambulance by their stretcher, and then they essentially just have him stand and pivot onto Duke and Snake's stretcher. Patient reports that their nausea is much worse when they stand after they lie down on Duke's stretcher, and they appear far more uncomfortable. Anyway, the patient's then moved into the ALS ambulance and placed on their monitor. Heart rate is 125. AFib, and while Snake doesn't remember the variability specifically, because I did ask, they don't recall it being below 110.
Okay.
Blood pressure comes back at 106 over 92 via manual, and the SpO2 has improved to 94% on room air. The patient again denies any pain, but Snake sees the patient's kind of like rub their, we'll call it upper abdomen, and inquires about it. And the patient just mentions that their stomach is uncomfortable, but attributes that to their nausea, which again was worse after having stood up. The patient is mildly moist. Well, their face area is, anyway, the facial region.
So this is like diaphoresis, not like moist clothes. Sorry, I'm just stuck. I just had that patient like stuck in my head.
Yeah. No, there was a bag of pee and...
bag of pee with medications and Ruffles potato chips inside.
Yeah, and they just ended up on his face somehow. We'll call it a light sheen of diaphoresis, not like, oh god,
okay,
you know, like
gotcha,
turn off
not
the
like
faucet.
He's having a STEMI diaphoresis, yeah. But all right, cool.
And they do start their transport code 1 at this time. Because of the syncope, Snake Eyes does do a 12-lead EKG, which they report showed AFib at a rate of 132, and what they call the left bundle branch block pattern. They didn't have the EKG for me, so, yeah. Okay. But
To be clear earlier, my EKG statement earlier, I would do one,
yeah,
but it would be after I chased down the why I think this paid. To me, it's secondary to this blood pressure that isn't getting better and my concerns for his hypovolemia. I'd be focusing on that first. I don't think that this is a bad move. I mean, I don't think getting one is a bad move at all. And if you have time for it, you absolutely should get one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think 12-lead is a good idea, especially with like a diabetic patient with neuropathy. That bumps it up a little bit, but I don't disagree with anything you said earlier. So here we go.
Yeah.
So as they start transporting, Snake Eyes does start an IV. They have a little bit of trouble locating an IV site because the patient's skin is super tough. Chris, you know what I'm talking about. Like you.
Oh yeah.
I've had needles bend on patient's skin.
Oh wow. I don't know if I've ever had a needle bend on patient's skin.
It was a smaller needle. Cause we, you know, I was like, there's something in there.
And
I kind of went in and it just bent.
Didn't want to go. Like, is that the same one that you've been reusing over and over again? Is that the reason why?
Hold on, you're not supposed to do that?
No. I mean, I know. Yeah, I know. It seems like because you get to pull it out of the sheath and keep it, right? Why not keep it, you know, still? But no. You gotta ditch them.
Oh, gotcha. I was like, no, I have my one, like, you know, like, this is my golden laryngoscope. I don't have one of those.
Oh, yeah.
But like, yeah, this is the,
your,
this is,
you're lucky.
Yeah, this is my lucky IV catheter.
He keeps using the EKG electrodes over and over again, too. It's those lucky electrodes. He's just got 10 of them in his pocket.
Yeah, you put a little Gorilla Glue on them and they stick. No problem.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, take Boom. That, diaphoresis.
Lots of patient's old skin stuck on it after you peel it off. Some Ruffles potato chips, too.
Jesus. Oh, man.
Oh, my goodness.
All right. Yeah. By the way, the patient's skin is not only tough, but it's also noted to be cold, which Snake Eyes did point out. And the patient goes like, yeah, this is normal. I have really bad circulation. So, yeah. Okay. So Snake Eyes says it took several attempts, but they were finally able to get a 22-gauge IV in the back of the patient's left hand. And they administered 4 milligrams of Zofran to help the patient with their nausea. And they also initiated a 500 milliliter bag of lactated ringers, figuring like, hey, some fluid would probably help the patient feel less ill. They kind of presumed at this point, and I think their care kind of shows this, like dehydration, alcohol is to blame here, is the route they're running down. And after that, they just sort of let the guy rest because otherwise he continues to just sort of be like, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So About 5 minutes out from the hospital, the patient tells Snake Eyes that they do feel a little bit better after the Zofran, and about 300 mils of that fluid has gone in. Their vitals appear slightly better to Snake as well. Excuse me, to Snake Eyes as well. The patient's heart rate is now between 100 and 120, and their blood pressure is 110 by palp. SpO2.
I don't like that they palped it.
SpO2 is 94%. Snake Eyes calls report in and gives them the quick synopsis of the story. A male who drank 4 times 24-ounce malt liquors had a possible single episode this evening. Patient's denying any pain, reports some residual nausea, which has improved with fluid and Zofran. Over the radio, they are directed to go to triage on arrival. So
this is just going to be bad. I just know it is. It's on this show. I mean, there's no fucking way this episode ends with them like, yeah, they went to triage, totally appropriate, and that's it. there's no way it ends that way.
Even if it did, I would still have words. I will just throw that out.
I would still have words too. But I'm just saying, like, it's not going to end that way. Because who would send that in?
No.
You know what I mean? That would not get sent in. So, all right. But anyway,
So, by the way, for the people who aren't in the, like, being sent to triage is essentially like, hey, take them out to the waiting room. And that happens.
It's the same spot that any.
That happens actually quite a bit. In EMS, because there are people who just they don't have an acute issue, or they don't have an emergent issue. You know, they need treatment. They're having pain. Something is wrong, but they don't need treatment now. But the guy who's having a heart attack in the waiting room probably does. You know, so there is, even if you come by ambulance, there is a decent chance that if it is not is a true health emergency. You could start out in the waiting room.
And so if you're not in EMS, I guess the bottom line is this: just because you go in by ambulance does not mean you get to skip the line. That's not how that works. There are people who have been sorely disappointed that I took them out to triage, but I took the ambulance. Like, that's not how it works.
And also,
it's not a golden ticket.
And also, this isn't really up to me.
That's the other thing too. I have no control over this.
All right. So after they arrive to the hospital, that's what they do. The patient is taken into triage and deposited in a wheelchair. Snake Ives gives report to the triage nurse, who's described as the opposite of excited to have this patient in the ED waiting room, and the crew clear and then immediately get tapped to another emergency. And so, Chris, I can already hear you going like, no, come on, there's more.
I just literally said that earlier.
Yeah.
Way to go, Nostradamus.
Thank you.
Sorry, go ahead.
That's a Michelle, please. Thank you.
Exactly. I forgot we did that in it. All right, go ahead.
But of course there is. Chris, now as the crew returned with what sounds like it was a little old lady who dared to challenge the gods of gravity, the charge nurse to the ED approaches Snake Eyes and, in his words, unloads upon him. Apparently, not long after they had left, Joe vomited up a hefty amount of coffee ground emesis mixed with, I'm sure, like Mad Dog.
And Ruffles potato chips.
Ruffles potato chips, Jesus. And then, Chris, syncopized and then fell onto the floor from the wheelchair.
Sure did. Oh, man.
This ends with the patient was ultimately diagnosed with a upper GI bleed and was taken to the operating room. It sounds like they had a kind of a complicated but successful stay and lived to be discharged.
Oh, my goodness. Did they say exactly what was bleeding?
He knew it was an upper GI bleed, and that was upper it.
Yeah, so I think so one of the things you guys may hear a lot of times is that coffee ground emesis. So I guess the difference between an upper GI bleed and a lower GI bleed, correct me if I'm wrong, Spence, I never am.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. It's basically when you're talking about upper GI, you're pretty much the stomach north. So stomach and esophagus. If something is bleeding in there, that's going to be an upper gastrointestinal bleed. Anything that is in the intestinal tract and, grind on out the butt. That is it. That's the lower half. And so when you have coffee ground emesis, the coffee ground look usually comes from blood sitting in the stomach. And it's just when the blood touches the stomach acid, it's just what it ends up looking like, is that coffee ground emesis. So because it no longer binds to oxygen and no longer oxidizes and turns black.
Yeah.
Coffee grounds. So, yeah, so that's, anyway, so yeah, that's interesting. But if you have more of a bright red coming out, that's usually more indicative of something that's esophageal, such as esophageal varices, because it won't spend long in the stomach before it gets back up. So there's that. Esophageal varices, by the way, is terrible. It's, you basically have distended.
And sort of a different mechanism from like the GI bleed too, because that one's more related really to like, hey, your liver circulation is bad and therefore blood is backing up. But
yeah, so what's going on there, and why that is kind of relevant to this dude though, is that he is an alcoholic, and it's liver disease. Like Spencer said, the veins that feed the liver, when they back up, when they start going back through the system, when they get backed up because your liver sucks, they also pass around the esophagus. And so they become distended. Like they're varicose veins, like you see on people's legs, but they're in your esophagus.
Yeah.
And then and then when they rupture, they're so damn hard to stop bleeding because like it's in the esophagus. Yeah. And even though they're veins, they bleed and bleed and bleed, and people can die.
The medical directors keep insisting that I cannot tourniquet people's necks. And I'm like, well, I mean,
stop it. No, God. Anyway,
take us to the
summary. That's my tangent.
Yeah, take us to the summary.
All right. So, so to summarize, Chris was right. The end. We'll see you guys later. That's it. All done.
Okay.
All right. We got shitty whiteboard. I keep doing this. Like as we write, I got to get a different whiteboard. I keep gripping my whiteboard up high as I get lower and lower, and my thumb just drags over everything that I wrote on the top half. So I'm always patching it back together. All right. 54-year-old male who drank like 4 malt liquors syncopizes after trying to stand up. So son calls 911. The BLS ambulance from the fire department gets there and says, with the syncopal episode, this guy's kind of tachycardic. He's nauseous. Let's just get an ALS intercept, which I agree. I think that's a good call. ALS crew arrives and they find an alert, but admittedly intoxicated patient at the chief complaint of nausea. And and then of course the sending crew also reports the high heart rate and the kind of borderline blood pressure, which I don't remember if anyone really, like, the blood pressure just kind of given, people are like, all right, moving on.
Yeah.
It didn't really seem to, I mean, to me, that was the part that stuck out. Anyway, moving on. So the crew, they take the patient, they do a 12 lead, they give some Zofran, which I think was a fine call. Yeah. They give some fluid, which is also a fine call. And then they deposit the patient in trash. So after they leave, Joe declares their GI emergency by vomiting up coffee ground emesis and then passing out, falling out of the wheelchair and hitting the floor. In spite of that, they ultimately live. And upon Snake Eye's return is chewed out by a nurse that is there, which, by the way, you guys got the same report and you still stuck him in triage. So not sure what your deal is, but anyway, don't yell at me. But anyway, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying the crew here did great either. There's misses.
There's a shared,
but you don't get to.
There's a shared responsibility.
But you don't get to go chew out the paramedic for getting the exact same information and then doing the same thing. That doesn't, you get off your high and mighty horse. You just saw it happen. Other than that, you were totally on board. You got the same report, the same history over the radio, and you said, put him in a wheelchair. And they said, gotcha. Oh, and then only when
I have no idea who took the report. That part I don't know. There's a
doesn't matter. They gave one. It doesn't matter. They gave one. If it was the charge nurse, then that charge nurse really shouldn't have done it. If it wasn't the charge nurse, I would like to think the charge nurse would be shit. Who took this report and said triage?
Yeah.
Which maybe they did. For all I know, they're just going, you know what? Actually, I'm going to take it back. For all I know, this charge nurse is just going right down the line, starting with their own staff. In that case, fair. You know?
Yeah.
Go right on down. If they're like, yeah, you took that report and you just said chill. Oh my God. But the medics seem chill. Yeah, no, I'll talk to them too, but get your shit together. And then, I could see that being the case. Maybe that was the case. I'll chill out. But if you didn't chew out your own people, then
is there? Hold on, I'm on this train with you now. Is there? Because no. Now I'm just like, oh, there's. I mean, what about the? You know, the way you say you present information has an immense effect on how it's received, right? So if you're hey, we got important. A drunk guy, and you might have passed out. I'm not saying that was, but like that kind of paints the picture to the ER.
It does. But again, I mean, if the ER can use that as an excuse, then so can our crew, because that's exactly what they got from the BLS team.
Yeah, we'll talk about that, because I think you hit the nail on the head. They had there was information there that was available that could have changed the entire course of the call that was just untouched and unexamined. And, you know, like if you're, I don't know, I mean, I would like to assume that the people bringing in patients, if you work in an ER, if you're, you know, like an ER nurse, you kind of hope that the people bringing in patients to you who are healthcare providers are examining stuff and like are going to point those things out and say, hey, and not just be like, yeah, drunk, here you go. But it's just me hoping the best out of people.
Absolutely. So let's kind of talk. I think I've got a lot of little things in terms of evaluating how the call was done. We will save that specific part for the very, very end.
Okay.
But I think I think that's what we kind of focus on right now is we really got to focus. I mean, there's some clinical stuff I do want to touch on and we're going to get there. But I think the big lesson here is that we all had information in front of us, and the BLS crew looked kind of, the BLS crew probably did the best out of anybody by upping it to ALS, but they still kind of gave the, this patient's drunk kind of thing. And to be honest, like it almost seemed like, Scarlett was the PIC in the back of the BLS ambulance and the other person was CC, right? No,
so there's Scarlett and Ripcord, and then a firefighter from their station was outside. Cobra Commander was outside, ready to kind of like, no, it's nothing, guys.
And so it seemed like I would actually say that, our two BLS responders inside the ambulance had the right idea by upping this, but then you had Cobra Commander being like, bah, on the outside. Now I get why they're the bad guy. There's that.
And just to be clear, they're the bad guy just for this call. Like, and everyone can wear that. I've been the Cobra Commander too.
I was going to say, just to be honest, you can be clear. I will be honest. I've been Cobra Commander. So I've been this guy, and I have been wrong. And that is why we do this show, because we realize that sometimes we can suck and we don't want you to suck.
Yeah.
So,
all right. Well,
let's kind of talk about this. Let's talk about, I got off track. which is crazy. I know. But what I'm saying is that we had kind of a chain of events where people saw what they wanted to see, not what was in front of them.
Yeah. And by the way, this is a very human thinking thing. And that's why I want to talk about this. I've mentioned Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, before, and I think it's going to come up again here, because I'm going to bring it up again here. In this book, Daniel divides our thinking into two categories, System 1 and System 2. Now, System 1, this is your like intuitive brain. Someone says pizza, and your brain, whether you like it or not, automatically comes up with ideas or images of pizza and associated things, such as deliciousness, delivery, DiGiorno, cheese, pepperoni, tomato sauce, black olives, raisins. Now you're probably using System 2, the analytic and also effortful conscious thinking system. And this is hopefully because System 1 encountered something that doesn't make sense, and it breaks the cohesive narrative that System 1 is otherwise giving you. And now it needs a little support because what the fuck? Raisins on pizza? But let's look at it another way. If I had said the following, I want a delivered dish with cooked dough, tomato sauce, lots of cheese all over it, olives, ooh, maybe some peppers, and sausage. Chris, what would you say I would be wanting?
Pizza?
Yeah, exactly. Your mind's probably right to pizza. It sounds like he wants pizza. But actually, I was thinking of a ravioli dish. in this instance.
Oh, look at
and
you.
And there's the catch to our human thinking. System one, likely, because I can't decide, I mean, it did for Chris, but, you know, to you listening, likely automatically offered you what it, yes, and I'm going to personify this system for a moment. It gave you what it thought would be the most correct answer, given the previous discussion. And system two, your analytic brain just kind of went like, it stamped its approval and went like, yeah, probably pizza. That makes sense. Sure.
Nailed it.
Yeah. Instead of saying like, hey, hold on, guys. Let's spend a bunch of energy and see if there are other details that we should know before we decide. Because system one gave it a cohesive answer with all the details. Excuse me. Because system one gave it a cohesive dancer. Jesus.
Cohesive dancer?
Yeah, I did.
Make me earn my editing chops here. Thanks, buddy. Dude.
System one gave your brain a cohesive answer with the details that were provided, and system two went like, yep, good. And Daniel Kahneman sums it up with this quote. The measure of success for system one is the coherence of a story it manages to create. The amount and quality of the data on which the story is based are largely irrelevant. When information is scarce, which is a common occurrence, System 1 operates as a machine for jumping to conclusions. And that is the problem. Our brains will examine the evidence that we have on hand and use those details and fill in the rest based on previous knowledge or assumptions or other heuristics to make a cohesive story, whether that story is true or not. And if it's the more cohesive it sounds, the more like you're like, yeah, then your brain is just more likely to be like, yep, that's good, without thinking about it.
So when he says the success of System One, he's not meaning its accuracy.
No.
He's meaning its ability to provide an answer that you'll go
exactly.
with.
Exactly. Yep.
Gotcha.
And so Snake admits that, like, given the information that they had on hand, the patient was likely drunk, and all the details they had on hand supported that coherent story, aside, Chris, from the blood pressure. You know, they've said like, yeah, I've seen and I can tell you, like, I've seen plenty of people like fail in their attempt to stand up after an evening of heavy drinking.
I've seen me do it.
One of my good friends at one point just stood up and then immediately fell over onto a table. We were
not me, but that, no, that wasn't
no,
me.
No, that was not Chris. That was my friend Driss. Yeah.
It actually wasn't me. I just want to make that clear.
Sure it wasn't, buddy. Sure it wasn't.
Unless I hit my head substantially hard. Yeah.
We know you can do that too. And that I will just, that I'll just take you to a bar.
Right. That's exactly what happened when we went snowboarding, by the way. Yep.
They did ask about pain, which the patient denied. And by the way, put a pin in that. And they didn't look or really look hard for alternative explanations or possibilities. And Daniel Kahneman explains this further in his book with the following acronym, WYSIWTI. That stands for, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What you see is what there is. And that is our tendency to focus on the evidence we see in front of us and ignore evidence that isn't present. Here's an example. If you restock a rig, and you don't use an inventory sheet, you just kind of do it off of memory, chances are that if there is an item that is low, you will see it and you'll recognize like, oh, there's supposed to be six of these and there's two.
Yeah.
I need to order four. But if there are none of the things and they're not an often used item, then that will just that you're like, yep, that empty space belongs there. That you will not see it because it's not there. And there is only what we see.
Yeah.
What we see is what there is.
Yeah. I mean, unless the empty space is obvious. Like I love it in I love cutout foam because like a hole in the shape of an IO gun is usually a good indicator that you should probably try and find that, but versus like, but you make a great point. Think of like ambulance cabinets and how much, you know, how much space we leave in those things all the time with just shit rattling around, you know, or The thing that immediately came to my mind is how most people store syringes. Like you have a stack of syringes, just kind of usually in the back, kind of all in front of one another. If all the 10cc syringes are gone and you're just kind of looking and seeing if everything's there, it's like, okay, well, the space seems full back there and, I got assorted sizes. It looks like everything's there and you go because, well, it didn't really look, there was no visual evidence or clue that anything was missing.
Yep.
So,
dude, totally. And so we worsen this problem by readily accepting the evidence we do have and putting that into a coherent narrative that our brains have already generated.
So, for example, you say plastic bag of medications. I immediately think pea-filled bag full of Ruffles potato chips and medications.
Yes, exactly.
There you're like, go.
Hold on, guys. Have we checked this bag of pills for pee? Like,
what about Ruffles? So, only Fritos? All right.
All right. So, Chris, how do you think we should overcome this problem in EMS? Let's start this discussion. Well, I'll get off my high horse on a book that everyone should read. It's fucking amazing.
So the only thing that Daniel Kahneman's thing is kind of missing a little bit is, you know, we're saying that we ignore evidence that isn't present. Sometimes we ignore evidence that is present that doesn't fit what System One's narrative is or what System One's idea is. And that is something we call outcome bias. Is that outcome bias? Is that what that is?
Confirmation bias.
Or confirmation bias.
To be fair, he does bring that up, but I figured I was on a soliloquy long enough. And so I left that part out. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's important because he is right, and what he said is right. But we also have to acknowledge then that there is confirmation bias, and that is just basically where even evidence that is there that will get ignored. In this case, like that blood pressure to me like stuck out like a sore thumb. Now, given I admit, my System One hears Spencer bringing a call, and I know it's going to be fucked up. Because that's what we do. I immediately think of the last time he brought a call and what happened then. So that was my System One working. So I think the best way to honestly like overcome this problem for me, first of all, be new again. And what I mean by that is I talk about this all the time, but those NREMT sheets, they're really, really good at casting a wide net. And a lot of times we just need to go down those NREMT sheets in our head, and it kind of puts us in that mindset of checking off everything for a patient. Now, I do cast some shade at NREMT because a lot of their assessment is designed to a lot of their assessment approach is designed to find one problem and fix it, which that's not our patients. But in terms of finding that one problem, it is good. It's a really good assessment, and it helps us cast that wide net. You and I have talked about this a lot. And what that kind of comes down to is I think it is perfectly acceptable to have I think I know what this is idea in your mind. What's not acceptable, though, is to accept that without really looking in to what you have. And one of the things that I want to point out is be specifically wary of the, well, it could be that this patient just drank too much this evening, and I'm going to go with that. Because alcohol intoxication, it can, so you gotta think about it. Whatever you think it is, it needs to provide you with a direction or a treatment modality, okay? Alcohol intoxication can provide you with that, but more often than not, I don't see responders using alcohol intoxication to provide them with a treatment path. I usually see them using alcohol intoxication to avoid a treatment path, and you don't want to do that. You should be approaching it like this. It could be that this patient just drank too much this evening, but it could also be B, C, D, E, or F, and I should start asking and looking for signs and symptoms that might support a different concern. And then it's just putting pieces of evidence into different bins and look for which bin's the fullest. Or sometimes, actually, I'm going to take that back. Not even necessarily which bin's the fullest. That does need to play some level in there, but you also need to look at which one's the most dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of times you're going to have things that are dangerous, but maybe not necessarily the best answer. Maybe there is a less dangerous answer that fits. But if we went with the more dangerous answer, which it could still be, then, okay, we're going to get into the hospital a little bit faster than we normally would. As long as you don't have treatments that may exacerbate the other problem, because then you do have a true conundrum there. It's often a lot of times it's not necessarily which is the most full evidence basket, but which one is the most dangerous one that could get to this patient that you can treat without exacerbating other possibilities. Anyway.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. That's a really good point. Because, and here's the thing is, like, yes, syncope has so many potential causes. And,
it does.
You know, like, half of them are benign-ish. Mm-hmm. You know, they're in the waiting room instead of in the room one.
Very but true.
There are others, like, just, it's like, yeah, just because some of them are, you know, mild doesn't mean, like, all of them are
right.
STEMI. There's Brugada syndrome. Brugada is it's like a sodium channel myopathy that causes patients to go into sudden cardiac arrest, pass out, and then many of them convert once they hit the ground out of VTAC. But there are patterns that can be recognized, and they need to be transported and evaluated, and probably have something put in so that. Next time they go and do. still looking for Brugada syndrome EKG. If any of you find people have run this call.
Wanted.
I want this. I have cookies and I will give you cookies.
All right. Dude, I'm fucking hanging you on that then, man.
I will send you cookies. All right.
There you go.
Aortic dissections, for instance, hemorrhage, dehydration, drug-induced orthostatic hypotension. Like, there are just so many causes.
Or GI bleed.
Yeah. Sometimes we don't get to dive too in-depth because, you know, we're trying to resuscitate a patient. It's like, yeah, I don't know. Let's keep doing CPR. The transport time doesn't allow for, like, a super in-depth history. But in this case, they could have used the time they had to, like, definitely ask the patient, like, hey, have you been sick lately? Eating well? Drinking water? Like, hey, have you had any changes in medications? You taking the time to look at the medications that were in the plastic bag. And by the way, like I said, they actually, what they did was they moved the patient, you know, like, oh, hey, here's your medications. And then they covered the patient with a blanket and just totally forgot until they got to the ER and then went like, well, they have the medications here.
They have the bag, which to me, again, is just a urine bag full of these things. A big thing about AFib patients very commonly have blood thinners prescribed. Because there's a problem, because atrial fibrillation, if you guys aren't familiar, AFib, the top half of the heart, which is the atria, they just fibrillate. And a lot of patients just kind of live with that. And so what it gives you a very irregular heart rhythm, but in and of itself, it's usually not that lethal. But usually these patients are usually on some kind of blocker, usually calcium channel blocker, that will help slow conduction through the AV node so their heart rate doesn't run away on them. And they're usually on a blood thinner because those wiggly little atria can sometimes allow blood to stagnate and clot in the heart itself. So they're usually on a blood thinner. So when you're talking about patients like this who have syncope and also a history of alcoholism, now they have blood thinners, you know, huge candidate there for GI bleed. So
in this case, I think the things they should have asked about specifically to this patient would have been the things that you brought up, Chris, which was like, hey, have you had any hematemesis? Hematemesis is coffee ground emesis, that digested blood in your vomit. By the way, per Medscape, 50% of patients with an upper GI bleed will have this sign. This is a big amount.
Yeah.
Melena, which is black tarry stools. Again, another sign of, like, blood that has gone through the digestive tract. That is a sensitive finding with 70 to 80% of upper GI bleeds having this.
Wow.
I'm going to not choke on this word. Hematochezia. And that is fresh or frank blood in the stool. And this is more common with lower GI bleeds, like you mentioned earlier. But it is also possible to have this with, they'd be larger upper GI bleeds, where it's like, yeah, there's so much blood, it doesn't have time to get digested. It's just shooting through the tract. Yeah. Other things they could have asked about that, like, hey, have you been feeling lightheaded? You know, like you're about to pass out. And 43% of patients who have upper GI bleeds also report that finding, which, you know, makes sense because your body is trying. It's like, well, what I see is what I have, and I don't have a lot of blood, and I'm just going to make do with what I've got. So, dyspepsia, especially at night, and that is indigestion, because we needed a better word than indigestion.
Right. We need a dyspepsia. Yeah. There you go.
So those are all things that they should have kind of followed through on asking about, like, hey, have you been having, you know, like, have you been, I mean, even just diet quite, you have to, so many opportunities.
Yeah. So one of the things that I actually kind of want to point out here, when it comes to syncopal episodes, I treat syncope just like I treat altered mental status. And I'm going to bring this up again. Because honestly, I'm proud of my little altered mental status thing because you guys keep telling me you like it. I will always say this: AEIOU TIPS is another acronym for remembering your altered mental status stuff. You should go look that up. That one is a more complete list. But a lot of things that can cause syncope are also the same things that can cause altered mental status. So, like, let's apply to this patient. So the first thing I always check is, okay, does it have fuel and is it good fuel? And basically what it means is, does the brain have blood going to it? Well, you evaluate that by evaluating a blood pressure. So in this case, the patient's not syncopizing now. So we know they're getting blood to the brain, at least now, but they did syncopize. And so the first thing when we got that blood pressure, that to me is an indicator that something is askew, that the fuel delivery system is doing its best to get fuel up there because something is failing. So that to me right there, we have problem with fuel delivery. Next up is it good fuel? Does it have sugar? Does it have oxygen? It does seem to have oxygen. Did they get a blood sugar?
They did not get a blood sugar.
They should have gotten a blood sugar. Yes, they should have. Because you do have a syncopal episode here. So they should have got a blood sugar on this patient. But yes, so they should have gotten a blood sugar and they should have got a SAT, which they did get a SAT, which was great. And the SAT was mid-90s. Throwing a nasal cannula on probably wouldn't hurt. It probably also wouldn't drastically help this guy either. So there you go.
Well, I mean, there's, you know, maximize the oxygen that the, you know, one red blood cell is right. trying to carry around.
Right. Well, I mean, in this case, they were never really going to address that part anyway. So but anyway. So the one red blood cell is fully saturated. Also, here's another thing I like to consider with oxygenation. If I think there's a chance that I may be intubating somebody, I start oxygenating right away so I can start denitrogenating the lungs. It's not really the saturation I care about. It's the air mix in the lungs so that when I do have to intubate and we're not able to breathe for them while I'm putting the tube in, they still, their saturations will stay higher longer. So there is that. So the fuel part. Next thing is it broken? And that's where we started. That's where I look at things like stroke and trauma. And so they had slurred speech. Slurred speech, if you have someone with slurred speech, even if they're drunk, that's actually a really good time to do a stroke scale. Is it the right away thing in this guy? No, not with that blood pressure they ignored. But the stroke scale at some point wouldn't be bad either when you have slurred speech on a syncopal episode patient. Next up is going to be, trauma. They asked about pain, which is great, but I mean, he's drunk also. That can help, that can really mask pain. So yeah. A trauma assessment would have been something that should have been good on this patient, especially when we're looking at that blood pressure. We really need to be looking for a sight of blood. Now, given like, Is there going to be if there was mass bleeding, that probably would have come out in the history. But also, I don't know, maybe you take a look, you look at the guy's shirt and he has some weird bruising on one side. And it's a lot of bruising. And then you find out, I've been falling a lot because, again, he has issues with alcoholism. Alcoholics tend to fall. So there is absolutely potential for trauma here. This could totally be one of those guys where you roll him over and it's like, oh, crap, like they fell and they've got broken ribs and bruising on one side and some sub-Q emphysema, like that kind of stuff. And it's like, holy, maybe this is why we have, the tachycardia and the failing blood pressure.
Dude, what was the call where they're like, all right, drunk guy, and then it was like, oh, you were shot and stabbed. Like, what?
Oh, yeah. I remember we reviewed that one. That one was, that was great. I remember that because someone was like, gosh, the ambulance sheet is pink when they moved the person over. I remember that.
I'm still terrified by the pink sheet. Like, they had pink sheets in that system.
Oh, but God. Yeah, anyway. So there's the trauma thing. And so also, like, I would say also put sepsis in there.
Yeah.
put sepsis in the broken part, which, I mean, again, a head to toe also helps with sepsis. I mean, we start talking about infections and, you know, with skin and lacerations, those kind of things. And then you move on to, you know, the last one there is intoxicated. Well, yes, he is intoxicated. We know that. He admits that. But explore other possibilities for intoxication. Sometimes people don't just take alcohol by themselves. If he's an alcoholic binging, he could have depression issues. Do we have medications that could potentially be harmful to him that are prescription medications? Does he have a history of other drug use? Those kind of things. I know we have a plastic baggie full of urine and pills that we didn't go through, but I know someone at this point is going to be listening, like, wait a second, does it have urine or does it not have urine? They've said it so many times by now, I don't remember if that's just Chris or if it did have urine in it. Anyway, it doesn't have urine in it. Well, I mean, I don't know. It may have urine in it. We didn't. It's basically, it's Schrodinger's pee bag at this point. We didn't look, so we don't know if it has urine in it or not. Or
you can't say that it doesn't have urine in it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the important thing. Yeah, we haven't measured it yet, so Schrodinger's quantum pee bag. Nice. But anyway, God, yeah. That's a t-shirt, Schrodinger's pee bag.
No, I think
to wear that. All right. Anyway, so yeah, sorry to go off on a tangent there, man, but I think treating syncope in the same manner that you treat altered mental status, but you've got to remember altered mental status is usually caused by some interruption to the brain, something wrong with the brain. So is syncope. Syncope usually is some reason that blood did not get to the brain. So there you go. I would treat it the same way. I left out a few. I didn't get too specific in there. I left out a few things as well, such as like, you know, history of seizures, those kind of things. Yeah. And then like the very last thing is it behavioral in my AMS thing, you know? And so I always leave behavioral to last because, I mean, there's very little that you're going to do. I mean, it's not critical. You know what I mean? Like no one's going to behavior themselves into death, you know, without like a means of trying to hurt themselves, in which case you'd go back to the other ones. But anyway.
All right.
Sorry to go on a tangent there, but I think it's important.
You and your tangents. Jesus. All right.
So kind of going to the call itself a little bit, kind of the specifics of the call here as we wrap this episode up. System issues. We always like to start there. I have a couple operational things that I didn't like. I have one operational thing that I didn't like.
Ooh, hit me with it.
Yeah, it's the sleep. I mean, whenever we have night shifts, you know, I mean, we love to pretend that our night shifters are just sleeping very well during the day. We're not. I used to be a night shifter. We're not. It's very difficult to do. You have to have a life that allows for that. And almost nobody does because the rest of the world is built to run the other 24 hours. It's very, very difficult to have a true night shift life where you sleep an appropriate amount during the daytime and get up at night. Yeah, blackout curtains help. But I mean, unless at some point you're going to spend time with family during the daytime or a friend or somebody. And you got to understand that's the equivalent of a normal nighttime person saying, you know what, tonight I'm going to stay up the whole night with my friends and then just go to work in the morning. It really doesn't work. But neither do 24-hour shifts, but that's a different story. But here's the thing that I did not like. When they were driving code 3, one person slept. Being a supervisor, one of the worst things that ever happened to the company that I worked at was I actually had two drivers. Neither of them were inattentive, but one of them had to focus on an issue with their mapping program and eyes were taken off the road. And I'm just going to say like, there's no point going into it, but really bad accident happened and there were good people involved that had a terrible outcome because of it. And so it bothers me when someone's going lights and sirens and the other person's sleeping. It also bothers me. I still pick up shifts and I'll have partners where I'll be going lights and sirens somewhere and they will start charting because they're backed up on charts. I don't care what system you work in. I don't care that you want to get off on time. Get off late if it means that when you're going code 3 with your lights and sirens, you have two people looking. You have to have two people out there looking. And so to have one of them sleep kind of chaps my hide a little bit. Don't sleep. Keep your eyes open because, you know, we're going to be going through red lights. We're going to be doing things that people don't expect. And you're at night. Half of the people out there are drunk anyway and trying to do the right thing. They probably think you're trying to pull them over. Some may run, which you could laugh, but it's happened. So So, yeah, again, if you are operating an ambulance and it goes lights and sirens, everyone in the ambulance needs to have head up, eyes open, looking for hazards. So, yeah. There we go.
Nice. All right. So, yeah, the pregame of sleep is probably a poor choice.
A good pregame.
Yeah. But then they got there and they got the history and they did an assessment. And I'm going to start with the things that I liked that I liked that they did do the 12 lead. And I know it's sort of like partial credit at this point, but you know, like, hey, we are worried about, you know, like Brugada syndrome. We're worried about STEMIs. We're worried about arrhythmias. Mm-hmm. You know, like there, and if you do a 12 lead and then you kind of keep the patient on the monitor, which it sounds like they did, not the 12 lead, but the monitor, then you're there kind of able to capture those arrhythmias or, you know, whatever as they pop up. And I thought that was a good thing. I also liked that both crew members, the BLS crew and this crew, the ALS crew, did take manual blood pressures. I, like you, I'm kind of like, yeah, that's probably the palpated one at the end, probably not great because we are looking for those narrowing pulse pressures, but you also have to be looking for those narrowing pulse pressures.
But I mean, still, very, very true.
But Chris, you pointed out, was there more that you liked in terms of assessment?
Yeah, I mean, there were some things that they did do well. And one of the things that I will say, kind of back on your 12-lead point, is it does show that at least in their headspace that they were turning over some of the rocks. I do appreciate that that they did transport. I mean, even though there was kind of the suggestion at one point where someone was like, really want to go to the hospital? And I'm thinking, I'm like, oh, it's on this show. It's on this show, man. He does. I feel like the guy yelling at the horror movie, like, never run up the stairs. You know, like that. Like, but at the same time, it's like, don't you know you're in a horror movie? And I'm like, don't you know you're in EMS 2020 right now? I mean, I am happy they went ahead with the transport. They didn't push for refusal. You and I have both seen some response. They can work up a magic refusal out of things they should not get refusal for.
Dude, for sure. Yeah.
And here's the thing. They did ultimately start an IV and they did ultimately give this patient fluid, which, I mean, unless you're carrying blood, in the case of a hypovolemic patient like this guy, fluid's going to be the treatment anyway. The only thing that you may change is because we didn't really do the problem with the position that these guys were in. So if we look at it from the point of what the patient had, the fluid was probably completely appropriate because we know what he had. But when you're in the situation that these responders were in and you haven't really done a trauma assessment, we really got to be careful about giving lots of fluid to a trauma patient who may be hypovolemic from, you know, occult bleeding inside their body. That is something you may have to worry about. We talked about that in past episodes. If you listen to the minivans and pedestrians, minivans and bicycles or bicycles and minivans. I'm not sure which one. That one's actually up on Guardian CME. If you haven't listened to it yet, that's a good place to go listen to it. Yeah. But we talk about the reasons why you really need to be careful about fluid in trauma patients. But that being said, for this patient, I think it's appropriate.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, in a way, this is sort of like a trauma patient, albeit without like the, because they are bleeding. But I think, again, like, it's telling that they gave fluid and like the patient's improved a little bit, you know, like.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, yes, they need blood, and I probably wouldn't give them a liter of fluid. I mean, I don't know. Maybe the alcohol with the dehydration like changes that. I don't know. That would be something I'd have to look up further.
Does bleeding into this? Because one of the big problems with trauma patients and lots of fluid is that you disrupt clotting factors. And I don't know how well clotting factors are working if we're bleeding into the GI space in the first place.
And patients also on blood thinners as well. And so that's, or potentially, somewhere in that pee bag.
Somewhere in the pee bag. In the Ruffles potato chip pee bag.
Man. All right. So homework for our listeners to tell us how we're wrong or right here. Because we're kind of stumbling into the area where we're not sure. Okay. But so I think there are, this sort of goes back to like, they failed to do a trauma assessment and they should have, especially given the fact that, again, like the patient has a history of neuropathy. And so like pain may not be the best indicator for them. You know,
And they're currently intoxicated
and they are. Yeah, they are drunk. Mm-hmm. AF. Adios. Let's talk about some of obviously we have the they didn't really dig into the history. It really does seem like they sort of accepted like, drunk is the answer. And by the way, some might ask, like, hey, how were they not curious? Like, because there's this high heart rate and this low blood pressure. But what about, and other people might be like, well, I mean, like, what about, like, I've seen alcohol cause high heart rates.
I'm going to say a lot of my drug patients usually seem to have high heart rates. I don't
know. They do. And that was Snake's comment. He was kind of like, I've transported many a drunk. And they all, then the heart rate and blood pressure make sense. And Chris.
It does not make sense. The blood pressure does not make sense. Anyway, go ahead.
Hold on here, sir. Well, so the diastolic doesn't make sense, but.
That's the point. That's my point.
But the otherwise, like, yeah, the 108 makes sense. Sure, the lower makes sense. Systolic in this situation. Here we go. I went on a little journey. So there is a link to drinking and higher heart rates. But the thing is, they're not sure why. The mechanism is up for debate. There's the thought of like, well, there's dehydration, which can then, of course, causes your body to go like, all right, let's move what we have faster. There could be an increased sympathetic output. There could also be some vasodilation effects. So there are explanations, but we're just not sure which of these causes it. Gotcha. What about alcohol and blood pressure? Because, you know, first, most of the time we associate alcohol use with hypertension. That's kind of the outcome of drinking too much on a regular basis. So you set yourself up to have high blood pressure. For some people, there can be a temporary decrease in blood pressure. A Cochran review, which from my understanding is kind of the like chef's kiss of reviews, they published in 2020 a review of several randomized controlled trials, and they came to this conclusion. High dose alcohol has a biphasic effect on blood pressure. It decreases blood pressure up to 12 hours after consumption and increases blood pressure after 13 hours after consumption. High dose alcohol increases heart rate at all times up to 24 hours. Findings of this review are relevant mainly to healthy males, as only small numbers of women were included in these trials. So if you are a healthy male, this is, and you drink a ton, you can be tachycardic and, you know, I guess have your blood pressure decreased to some degree.
Systolic.
And then after that, it go exactly systolic. Anyway, so I thought that was interesting because that was something I've always been like, I think this is a thing. Yeah. And so they thought it was a thing and I wasn't sure.
So, I mean, I will give some leeway in the sense that, you know, I mean, of course, like the tachycardia, I mean, I agree with Snake Eyes. Tachycardia, lower systolic, that all lines up. But to me, that diastolic was just so consistently high that that's what takes away from alcohol. So, I'm going to say this. I'm going to recommend a Mythbusters episode. The vasodilation from alcohol, I knew, and I first learned it. I mean, it's since been reinforced by more legitimate sources, but I learned it from an episode of Mythbusters where they were testing that if alcohol actually makes you warm, and they did find out that it actually increased their skin temperature, but their core temperature did not change. And the reason that is because vasodilation allows blood to, because the alcohol causes vasodilation, and it allows blood to go to the surface where it will off-put body heat for a little bit of time. The problem is that if you're in a cold environment, which is what they were testing, they would rapidly get colder shortly after that. So they drink alcohol, you'd see an increase in their skin temp pretty drastically at first. But now, of course, what's happening to all that heat that's moving to the outside, it's getting rapidly cooled. And so they determined that drinking alcohol is actually worse for you when you're cold, because you will become, you'll feel slightly warmer for a small bit of time before you become severely hypothermic. Anyway.
Low and so, be cold, baby.
So, like, yeah, exactly. Then fall into a ditch. But anyway, so that is why the vasodilation part, and when I talked about, you know, diastolic BPs, that's why diastolic BPs are so important. We really don't emphasize diastolic BPs in EMS enough, because most of our protocols, when we're talking about blood pressure, is almost always focused on that systolic. Because we're always worried about, okay, what's the maximum pressure? In other words, like how much blood is getting to the brain? We don't really determine that with the diastolic. But the diastolic can give you a lot of clues as to what's going on in this case. And when we have an alcoholic, we should be suspecting vasodilation. When you have a high diastolic number, you should be expecting the opposite. It's vasoconstriction. Because you got to remember, the diastolic is the lowest pressure in that system. So if the lowest pressure is high, that means without any input from the heart at all, the vasculature is exerting that much pressure onto the system. And so that's why this, that's kind of why I not teed off, but that's kind of like, nah, it doesn't make sense. The whole picture of the blood pressure doesn't make sense, but I do give them credit. Have I seen systolic blood pressures and heart rates like that in drunk people before? Abso-frickin-lutely. Very, very true.
Yeah. Yep. No. Again, you know, like this is why we're all susceptible to this sort of error.
We absolutely are. We're all susceptible, and we've all done it. Yeah. And just so you guys know, like I'm teeing off on it, but like I've done it. So
yeah,
I can't tee off too hard.
All right. So I think I don't know what was said to the triage nurse, and all of that. So I can't speak to that handoff. But I do want to say, based on the story that I was given, I really did like the report that Scarlett and Ripcord, Scarlett provided. I agree that this was a perfect use of ALS. Not just because of the outcome. Even if it had just been a drunk guy who sat in an ER and was totally fine, I think there's still, like, it was still warranted. It's a syncopal patient who's having palpitations. They're intoxicated. You know, they're nauseated. It's like, even just for symptom relief, like, hey, you guys have Zofran, you guys have fluids, like,
yeah,
help this guy out.
Better, you know, patient, like, care, and there's more assessment tools available, so I think that's absolutely good. So yeah, for BLS providers out there, this is a great use of ALS Intercept.
And I if there is something that needs to be said, that needs to be communicated to an ALS, like to you know, a handoff provider, and you're worried about the patient, that, hey, writing something down on the sheet and just kind of circling it, that is a perfectly good method to get information, unless I have follow-up questions, and which then I'm like, can I borrow your paper? And then we're just writing notes to each other behind the patient's back.
Check yes or no. Give it over. another thing that I do want to point out, though, is that if you're looking at vital signs, and I don't know if this happened, but I've seen this before and I've heard of it before. Actually, I've done this before. Sometimes someone will see a vital sign, like, let's say the BLS crew saw that blood pressure and they're like, oh, that systolic or that diastolic's too high, I'm actually worried about a bleed. A lot of times, instead of making a statement for fear of being laughed at for being wrong, people will just list the vital signs and just assume that, well, clearly the paramedic didn't react when I said that, so I must be wrong. Don't.
Yeah.
Feel free to present as a BLS provider. Feel free to present your clinical impression. There's nothing wrong with you being like, hey, they got this blood pressure. I'm concerned that they might be hypovolemic for some reason, more than just, you know, beyond maybe alcoholism. I'm concerned about this because that diastolic is really high. And then at that point, like, they may still at their own peril ignore you, or they may point out to you like, yeah, I get that, but here's why I don't think that is the case. And then everybody learns and grows if they're a good provider, or if they're a really good provider, they'll be like, holy shit, you're right. And then they'll carry on. But one other thing I'm going to add, I mean, I don't know about you, I'm kind of ready to wrap this up, but one other thing I want to add. Remorseful patients who don't want to go, I don't know if he wanted to go because the son wanted him to go, but he was really remorseful, really like, I'm so sorry, and just really kind of, you know, like, I'm an idiot, sorry for bothering you guys, that kind of stuff. These are also people who are going to be reluctant to complain, because they don't want to be there, or rather, they don't want to bother you. And so when someone is like this and like, oh, I'm just drunk, they have a tendency when you're like, hey, anything wrong? No. I'm okay. I'm drunk. I need to go. My son wants me to go. So be suspicious of their answers a little bit and really start, make sure that your objective assessments are better, because I've had this case are thorough. And so because I've had this case before where I've had alcohol people say, no, I'm fine. Sorry, guys, I'm just drunk. I'm really fine. I gotta go to the hospital. I'm fine. And then I'm like, all right, we can do a physical assessment. And you're just kind of like, oh, hey, like, you've been hiding your arm from me. It looks broken. Like, it's messed up. And they're like, well, I fell on it, but it hurts, but it's no big deal. And you look at it and you're like, oh, no, buddy, like, your wrist is fractured. You know, like, that kind of stuff. So
yeah.
Just be careful on these people because they're drunk. They're not feeling the pain that they're feeling. And if they're remorseful, they may also be reluctant.
Minimizers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Just another form of minimizers. So, Spence, anything else before we go?
No, man.
That's, you want to take us out awkwardly? Can you take us out awkwardly?
Oh, I'm ready to take you out awkwardly. Chris actually solved the whole thing. Every 911 call you go, every call that you respond on, just imagine it's me giving you the call.
There you go.
That's solved it. We have solved the problem of human thinking.
Yeah, you'll just be like, ah, crap. You know, I did have a partner once that we're just going to say our boss's name was Johnson. And he always said, yeah, before I ever do anything, I always go like this. So Mr. Johnson, and then I say what I'm going to do. If it still sounds like a good idea, then I do it. And so that's a good thing. Just put your boss's name in front of anything you're about to do. And if it still sounds solid, you're good to go. All right, with that, everybody, thanks again for listening to another episode of EMS 2020. Go check out our YouTube channel. It's Rapid Sequence Information on YouTube. You can find the links on our social media. And also, finally, just searching Rapid Sequence Information on YouTube should turn up the right one. Don't search EMS 2020. You won't find it. But you will find Rapid Sequence Information. I don't know why I changed the name. And there's some videos up there. Please go subscribe and like. If you want your call to be on this wonderful show here and maybe give somebody else some continuing education, then submit your call to EMS2020podcast@gmail.com. Check us out on social media. It's EMS20/20 on Facebook. And we are at EMS2020 Show on Instagram. With that, goodbye.